The Hammerhorn's iron gates had been closed and barred for the night. Aaron beat on them with a rock until the clanging woke a guard. The youth who admitted him was the image of Gorman, whose horse he'd taken. "Which one are you?" Aaron demanded.
"Gran, my father awaits you within."
The hall was dank and draughty, full of shadows. One of Garl's daughters offered the priest a horn of ale. Another poked at a sullen fire that was giving off more smoke than heat. Garald Goodbrother himself was talking quietly with a slim man in fine grey robes, who wore about his neck a chain of many metals that marked him for a maester of the citadel. "Where is Gormund?" Garald asked when he saw Aaron.
"He returns afoot. Send your women away, my lord, and the maester as well."
He had no love of maesters. The ravens were creatures of the storm god, and he did not trust their healing, not since Yuri.
"No proper man would choose a life of thraldom, nor forge a chain of servitude to wear about his throat."
"Gisela, Gwyn, leave us," Goodbrother said curtly.
"You as well, Gran. Maester Murrenmoor will stay."
"He will go," insisted Aaron.
"This is my hall, Dunfer. It's not for you to say who must go and who remains. The maester stays."
"The man lives too far from the sea," Aaron told himself.
"Then I shall go,"
he told Goodbrother. Dry rushes rustled underneath the cracked soles of his bare black feet as he turned and stalked away. It seemed he had ridden a long way for naught. Aaron was almost at the door when the maester cleared his throat and said,
"Euron Crow's Eye sits the sea-stone chair."
The damfair turned. The hall had suddenly grown colder.
"The Crow's Eye is half a world away. Balin sent him off 2 years ago, and swore that it would be his life if he returned."
"Tell me," he said hoarsely.
"He sailed into Lordsport the day after the king's death, and claimed the castle and the crown as Balin's eldest brother," said Garl Goodbrother. "Now he sends forth ravens, summoning the captains and the kings from every isle to pike, to bend their knees and do him homage as their king."
"No,"
Aaron Damfair did not weigh his words,
"only a godly man may sit the sea's stone chair. The Crow's Eye worships naught but his own pride."
"You were on pike not long ago, and saw the king," said Goodbrother. "Did Balin say aught to you of the succession?"
"Aye," they had spoken in the sea tower, as the wind howled outside, the windows and the waves crashed restlessly below. Balin had shaken his head in despair when he heard what Aaron had to tell him of his last remaining son.
"The wars have made a weakling of him, as I feared," the king had said. "I pray God that they killed him, so he cannot stand in Asher's way."
That was Balin's blindness. He saw himself in his wild, headstrong daughter, and believed she could succeed him. He was wrong in that, and Aaron tried to tell him so.
"No woman will ever rule the Ironborn, not even a woman such as Asher," he insisted.
But Balin could be deaf to things he did not wish to hear. Before the priest could answer Garl Goodbrother, the maester's mouth flapped open once again.
"By rights, the sea-stone chair belongs to Theon, or Asher, if the prince is dead. That is the law."
"A green land law," said Aaron with contempt. "What is that to us? We are Ironborn, the sons of the sea, chosen of the drowned god. No woman may rule over us, nor any godless man."
"And Victarion?" asked Garl Goodbrother. "He has the iron fleet." "Will Victarion make a claim, Dunfer?"
"Euron is the elder brother," began the maester.
Aaron silenced him with a look. In little fishing towns and great stone keeps alike, such a look from Damfair would have made maids feel faint and sent children shrieking to their mothers, and it was more than sufficient to quell the chain-necked thrall.
"Urin is elder," the priest said, "but Viterion is more godly."
"Will it come to war between them?" asked the maester.
"Ironborn must not spill the blood of Ironborn."
"A pious sentiment, Dumfair," said Goodbrother, "but not one that your brother shares. He had Swain Butley drowned for saying that the Seastone Chair by right belonged to Theon."
"If he was drowned, no blood was shed," said Aaron. The maester and the lord exchanged a look. "I must send word to Pike, and soon," said Goril Goodbrother. "Dampier, I would have your counsel. What shall it be, homage or defiance?"
Aaron tugged his beard and thought, "I have seen the storm, and its name is Urin Crow's Eye."
"For now, send only silence," he told the lord. "I must pray on this."
"Pray all you wish," the maester said. "It does not change the law."
"Theon is the rightful heir, and Asher next."
"Silence!"
Aaron roared. "Too long have the Ironborn listened to you chain-necked maesters prating of the green lands and their laws. It is time we listen to the sea again. It is time we listen to the voice of God."
His own voice rang in that smoky hall, so full of power that neither Goril Goodbrother nor his maester dared a reply.
"The drowned god is with me," Aaron thought. "He has shown me the way."
Goodbrother offered him the comforts of the castle for the night, but the priest declined. He seldom slept beneath a castle roof, and never so far from the sea.
"Comforts I shall know in the drowned god's watery halls beneath the waves. We are born to suffer. That our suffering might make us strong. All that I require is a fresh horse to carry me to Pebbleton."
That good brother was pleased to provide. He sent his son Graydon as well, to show the priest the shortest way through the hills down to the sea. Dawn was still an hour off when they set forth, but their mounts were hardy and sure-footed, and they made good time despite the darkness. Aaron closed his eyes and said a silent prayer, and after a while began to drowse in the saddle. The sound came softly, the scream of a rusted hinge.
"Uri," he muttered, and woke fearful. "There is no hinge here, no door, no Uri."
A flying axe took off half of Uri's hand when he was 10 and 4, playing at the finger dance whilst his father and elder brothers were away at war. Lord Kellan's third wife had been a piper of Pink Maiden Castle, a girl with big soft breasts and brown doe's eyes. Instead of healing Uri's hand the old way, with fire and seawater, she gave him to the Greenlands maester, who swore that he could sew back the missing fingers. He did that, and later he used potions and poultices and herbs, but the hand mortified, and Uri took a fever. By the time the maester sawed his arm off, it was too late. Lord Kellan never returned from his last voyage. The drowned god, in his goodness, granted him a death at sea. It was Lord Balin who came back, with his brothers, Urin and Viktarion. When Balin heard what had befallen Uri, he removed 3 of the maester's fingers with a cook's cleaver, and sent his father's piper wife to sew them back on. Poultices and potions worked as well for the maester as they had for Urigan. He died raving, and Lord Quellan's third wife followed soon thereafter, as the midwife drew a stillborn daughter from her womb. Aaron had been glad. It had been his axe that sheared off Uri's hand, whilst they danced the finger dance together, as friends and brothers will. It shamed him still to recall the years that followed Uri's death. At 6 and 10 he called himself a man, but in truth he had been a sack of wine with legs. He would sing, he would dance, but not the finger dance, never again. He would jape and jabber and make mock. He played the pipes, he juggled, he rode horses, and could drink more than all the winches and the butleys and half the harlaws, too. The drowned god
gives every man a gift, even him. No man could piss longer or further than Aaron Greyjoy, as he proved at every feast. Once he bet his new longship against a herd of goats that he could quench a hearth fire with no more than his cock. Aaron feasted on goat for a year, and named the longship Golden Storm. Though Balin threatened to hang him from her mast when he heard what sort of ram his brother proposed to mount upon her prow. In the end, the Golden Storm went down off Fair Isle during Balin's first rebellion, cut in half by a towering war galley called Fury, when Stannis Baratheon caught Victarion in his trap and smashed the Iron Fleet. Yet the guard was not done with Aaron, and carried him to shore. Some fishermen took him captive and marched him down to Lannisport in chains, and he spent the rest of the war in the bowels of Casterly Rock, proving that krakens can piss farther and longer than lions, boars, or chickens.
"That man is dead." Aaron had drowned and been reborn from the sea, the guard's own prophet. No mortal man could frighten him, no more than the darkness could, nor memories, the bones of the soul. The sound of a door opening, the scream of a rusted iron hinge. Urin has come again.
It did not matter. He was a Damfire priest, beloved of the god.
"Will it come to war?"
asked Graydon Goodbrother, as the sun was lightening the hills.
"A war of brother against brother. If the drowned god wills it, no godless man may sit the sea-stone chair. The crow's eye will fight, that is certain.
No woman could defeat him, not even Asher. Women were made to fight their battles in the birthing bed, and Theon, if he lived, was just as hopeless, a boy of sulks and smiles. At Winterfell he proved his worth, such that it was, but the crow's eye was no crippled boy. The decks of Euron's ship were painted red to better hide the blood that soaked them.
Victarion, the king, must be Victarion, or the storm will slay us all.
Greydon left him when the sun was up, to take the news of Balin's death to his cousins in their towers at Down-Delving, Crowspike Keep, and Corpse Lake. Aaron continued on alone, up hills and down vales, along a stony track that drew wider and more travelled as he neared the sea. In every village he paused to preach, and in the yards of petty lords as well.
"We were born from the sea, and to the sea we all return," he told them. His voice was as deep as the ocean, and thundered like the waves. "The storm god, in his wrath, plucked Balin from his castle and cast him down, and now he feasts beneath the waves in the drowned guard's watery halls." He raised his hands. "Balon is dead! The king is dead! Yet a king will come again, for what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger. A king will rise!"
Some of those who heard him threw down their hoes and picks to follow, so by the time he heard the crash of waves, a dozen men walked behind his horse, touched by God and desirous of drowning. Pebbleton was home to several thousand fisherfolk whose hovels huddled around the base of a square tower house with a turret at each corner. 20 of Aaron's drowned men there awaited him, camped along a grey sand beach in sealskin tents and shelters built of driftwood. Their hands were roughened by brine, scarred by nets and lines, calloused from oars and picks and axes. But now those hands gripped driftwood cudgels hard as iron, for the guard had armed them from his arsenal beneath the sea. They had built a shelter for the priest, just above the tide line. Gladly he crawled into it, after he had drowned his newest followers.
"My God," he prayed, "speak to me in the rumble of the waves, and tell me what to do. The captains and the kings await your word. who shall be our king in Balan's place? Sing to me in the language of Leviathan, that I may know his name. Tell me, O Lord, beneath the waves, who has the strength to fight the storm on Pike?
Though his ride to Hammerhorn had left him weary, Aaron Damfair was restless in his driftwood shelter, roofed over with black weeds from the sea. The clouds rolled in to cloak the moon and stars, and the darkness lay as thick upon the sea as it did upon his soul.
Balon favoured Asher, the child of his body, but a woman cannot rule the Ironborn. It must be Victarion.
9 sons had been born from the loins of Kellan Greyjoy, and Victarion was the strongest of them, a bull of a man, fearless and dutiful.
And therein lies our danger.
A younger brother owes obedience to an elder, and Victarion was not a man to sail against tradition.
He has no love for Euron, though, not since the woman died.
Outside, beneath the snoring of his drowned men and the keening of the wind, he could hear the pounding of the waves, the hammer of his god calling him to battle. Aaron crept from his little shelter into the chill of the night. Naked he stood, pale and gaunt and tall, and naked he walked into the black, salt sea. The water was icy cold, yet he did not flinch from his god's caress. A wave smashed against his chest, staggering him. The next broke over his head. He could taste the salt on his lips and feel the guard around him, and his ears rang with the glory of his song. 9 sons were born from the loins of Kellan Greyjoy, and I was the least of them, as weak and frightened as a girl. But no longer. That man is drowned, and the guard has made me strong. The cold salt sea surrounded him, embraced him, reached down through his weak man's flesh, and touched his bones.
Bones, he thought, the bones of the soul. Balon's bones and Yuri's. The truth is, in our bones, for flesh decays, and bone endures. And on the hill of Naga, the bones of the grey king's hall.
And gaunt and pale and shivering, Aaron Damfair struggled back to the shore, a wiser man than he had been when he stepped into the sea. For he had found the answer in his bones, and the way was plain before him. The night was so cold that his body seemed to steam as he stalked back towards his shelter. But there was a fire burning in his heart, and sleep came easily for once, unbroken by the scream of iron hinges. When he woke, the day was bright and windy. Aaron broke his fast on a broth of clams and seaweed cooked above a driftwood fire. No sooner had he finished than the Merlin descended from his tower house with 6 guards to seek him out.
"The king is dead," the Damfair told him.
I had burg, and now another."
The Merlin was a bald, round, fleshy man who styled himself Lord in the manner of the Greenlands, and dressed in furs and velvets.
"One raven summoned me to Pike, another to 10 towers. Your krakens have too many arms. You pull a man to pieces. What say you, priest? Where should I send my longships?"
Aaron scowled.
10 towers, did you say? What kraken called you there?"
10 towers was the seat of the Lord of Harlaw.
"The Princess Asher, she has set her sails for home. The reader sends out ravens, summoning all her friends to Harlaw. He says that Balon meant for her to sit the sea-stone chair. The drowned god shall decide who sits the sea-stone chair," the priest said. "Kneel, that I might bless you."
Lord Merlin sank to his knees and Aaron uncorked his skin and poured a stream of seawater on his bald pate.
"Lord God, who drowned for us, let Meldred, your servant, be born again from the sea. Bless him with salt, bless him with stone, bless him with steel." Water ran down Merlin's fat cheeks to soak his beard and fur fox mantle. "What is dead may never die," Aaron finished, "but rises again harder and stronger."
But when Merlin rose, he told him,
"Stay and listen, that you may spread God's word."
3 feet from the water's edge, the waves broke around a rounded granite boulder. It was there that Aaron Damfair stood, so all his school might see him and hear the words he had to say.
"We were born from the sea, and to the sea we will return," he began, as he had 100 times before. "The storm god, in his wrath, plucked Balin from his castle and cast him down, and now he feasts beneath the waves." He raised his hands. "The Iron King is dead, yet a king will come again, for what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger."
"A king shall rise," the drowned men cried.
"He shall, he must, but who?"
The Damfair listened for a moment, but only the waves gave answer.
"Who shall be our king?"
The drowned men began to slam their driftwood cudgels one against the other.
"Damfair," they cried, "Damfair king, Aaron king, give us Damfair."
Aaron shook his head.
"If a father has 2 sons, and gives to one an axe, and to the other a net, which does he intend should be the warrior?"
"The axe is for the warrior," Rush shouted back, "the net for a fisher of the seas."
"Aye," said Aaron, "the god took me deep beneath the waves, and drowned the worthless thing I was. When he cast me forth again, he gave me eyes to see, ears to hear, and a voice to spread his word, that I might be his prophet and teach his truth to those who have forgotten. I was not made to sit upon the sea-stone chair, no more than Euron Crow's eye, for I have heard the god who says, 'No godless man may sit my sea-stone chair.'"
The Merlin crossed his arms against his chest.
"Is it Eärendil or Victarion? Tell us, priest."
"The drowned god will tell you, but not here."
Aaron pointed at the Merlin's fat white face.
"Look not to me, nor to the laws of men, but to the sea. Raise your sails and unship your oars, my lord, and take yourself to Old Wyke. You and all the captains and the kings, go not to Pike to bow before the godless, nor to Harlaw to consort with scheming women. Point your prow towards Old Wyke, where stood the Grey King's Hall. In the name of the drowned god, I summon you. I summon all of you. Leave your halls and hovels, your castles and your keeps, and return to Naggers Hill to make a king's moot."
The Merlin gaped at him.
"A king's moot? There has not been a true king's moot in too long a time," Aaron cried in anguish. "Yet in the dawn of days the Arnborn chose their own kings, raising up the worthiest among them. It is time we returned to the old way, for only that shall make us great again. It was a king's moot that chose Eurus Ironfoot for High King, and placed a driftwood crown upon his brows. Silas Flatnose, Harrog Hoare, the old Kraken, the king's moot raised them all.
and from this king's moot shall emerge a man to finish the work King Balin has begun, and winners back are freedoms. Go not to Pike, nor to the Tentars of Harlaw, but to old Wyke. I say again, seek the hill of Negger and the bones of the Grey King's Hall. For in that holy place, when the moon has drowned and come again, we shall make ourselves a worthy king, a godly king. He raised his bony hands on high again. Listen, listen to the waves, listen to the God. He is speaking to us, and he says, we shall have no king but from the king's moot. A roar went up at that, and the drawn men beat their cudgels one against the other. A king's moot, they shouted. A king's moot, a king's moot. No king but from the king's moot. And the clamour that they made was so thunderous that surely the crow's eye heard the shouts on Pike, and the vile storm god in his cloudy hall. And Aaron Damfair knew he had done well.
The Captain of Guards.
The blood oranges are well past ripe,
the prince observed in a weary voice, when the captain rolled him onto the terrace. After that, he did not speak again for hours. It was true about the oranges. A few had fallen to burst open on the pale pink marble. The sharp, sweet smell of them filled Hotar's nostrils each time he took a breath. No doubt the prince could smell them, too, as he sat beneath the tree in the rolling chair Maester Caliot had made for him, with its goose-down cushions and rumbling wheels of ebony and iron. For a long while the only sounds were the children splashing in the pools and fountains, and once a soft plop as another orange dropped onto the terrace to burst. Then from the far side of the palace the captain heard the faint drumbeat of boots on marble. Obara. He knew her stride. Long-legged, hasty, angry. In the stables by the gates her horse would be lathered and bloody from her spurs. She always rode stallions, and had been heard to boast that she could master any horse in Dawn, and any man as well. The captain could hear other footsteps as well, the quick, soft scuffing of Maester Caliot, hurrying to keep up. Obara Sand always walked too fast.
She is chasing after something she can never catch, the prince had told his daughter once, in the captain's hearing.
When she appeared beneath the triple arch, Arya Hotar swung his long axe sideways to block the way. The head was on a shaft of mountain ash 6 feet long, so she could not go around.
My lady, no farther.
His voice was a bass grumble, thick with the accents of Norvus.
The prince does not wish to be disturbed.
Her face had been stone before he spoke, then it hardened.
You are in my way, Hotar.
Obara was the eldest sand snake, a big-boned woman near to 30, with a close-set eyes and rat-brown hair of the old town whore who'd birthed her. Beneath a mottled sand-silk cloak of dun and gold, her riding clothes were of old brown leather, worn and supple. They were the softest things about her. On one hip she wore a coiled whip, across her back a round shield of steel and copper. She had left her spear outside. For that, Arya Hotar gave thanks. Quick and strong as she was, the woman was no match for him. He knew, but she did not, and he had no wish to see her blood upon the pale pink marble. Maester Caliot shifted his weight from foot to foot.
Lady Obara, I'll try to tell you.
Does he know that my father is dead? Obara asked the captain, paying the maester no more mind than she would a fly, if any fly had been foolish enough to buzz about her head.
He does, the captain said. He had a bird.
Death had come to dawn on raven wings, writ small and sealed with a blob of hard red wax. Caliot must have sensed what was in that letter, for he'd given it to Hotar to deliver. The prince thanked him, but for the longest time he would not break the seal. All afternoon he sat with a parchment in his lap, watching the children at their play. He watched until the sun went down, and the evening air grew cool enough to drive them inside. Then he watched the starlight on the water. It was moonrise before he sent Hotar to fetch a candle, so he might read his letter beneath the orange trees in the dark of night. Obara touched her whip.
"Saladins are crossing the sands afoot to climb the bone way, so they may help Ilaria bring my father home. The septs are packed to bursting, and the red priests have lit their temple fires. In the pillow houses women are coupling with every man who comes to them and refusing any coin. In Sunspear, on the Broken Arm, along the Green Blood, in the mountains, out in the deep sand, everywhere, everywhere, women tear their hair and men cry out in rage. The same question is heard on every tongue. What will Doran do?
What will his brother do to avenge our murdered prince? She moved closer to the captain.
And you say he does not wish to be disturbed?
He does not wish to be disturbed,
Ariel Hotar said again. The captain of guards knew the prince he guarded. Once, long ago, a callow youth had come from Norvos, a big broad-shouldered boy with a mop of dark hair. That hair was white now, and his body bore the scars of many battles. But his strength remained, and he kept his long axe sharp, as the bearded priests had taught him.
"She shall not pass," he told himself, and said, "The prince is watching the children at their play. He is never to be disturbed when he is watching the children at their play."
"Hotar," said Obara Sen, "you will remove yourself from my path, else I shall take that long axe and—"
"Captain," came the command from behind, "let her pass. I will speak with her."
The prince's voice was hoarse. Ario Hotar jerked his long axe upright and stepped to one side. Obara gave him a lingering last look and strode past, the maester hurrying at her heels. Caliot was no more than 5 feet tall and bald as an egg. His face was so smooth and fat that it was hard to tell his age. But he had been here before the captain, had even served the prince's mother. Despite his age and girth, he was still nimble enough, and clever as they came, but meek.
"He is no match for any sand snake," the captain thought.
In the shade of the orange trees, the prince sat in his chair with his gouty legs propped up before him and heavy bags beneath his eyes. Though whether it was grief or gout that kept him sleepless, Hotar could not say. Below in the fountains and the pools, the children were still at play. The youngest was no more than 5, the oldest 9 and 10. Half were girls and half were boys. Hotar could hear them splashing and shouting at each other in high, shrill voices.
"It was not so long ago that you were one of the children in these pools, Obara,"
the prince said, when she took one knee before his rolling chair. She snorted.
"It has been 20 years, or near enough to make no matter, and I was not here long. I am the whore's whelp, or had you forgotten?"
When he did not answer, she rose again and put her hands upon her hips.
"My father has been murdered.
He was slain in single combat during a trial by battle," Prince Doran said. "By law, that is no murder."
"He was your brother."
"He was."
"What do you mean to do about his death?"
The prince turned his chair laboriously to face her. Though he was but 52, Doran Martell seemed much older. His body was soft and shapeless beneath his linen robes, and his legs were hard to look upon. The gout had swollen and reddened his joints grotesquely. His left knee was an apple, his right a melon, and his toes had turned to dark red grapes, so ripe it seemed as though a touch would burst them. Even the weight of a coverlet could make him shudder, though he bore the pain without complaint.
"A silence is a princess' friend,"
the captain had heard him tell his daughter once.
"Words are like arrows, Ariane. Once loosed, you cannot call them back. I have written to Lord Tywin. Written? If you were half the man my father was, I am not your father. That I knew."
O'Bara's voice was thick with contempt.
"You would have me go to war?"
"I know better. You need not even leave your chair.
Let me avenge my father. You have a host in the Prince's Pass, Lord Ironwood as another in the Boneway. Grant me the one and Nim the other. Let her ride the King's Road while I turn the Marcher Lords out of their castles and hook round to march on Old Town."
"And how could you hope to hold Old Town?"
"It will be enough to sack it. The wealth of Hightower, is it gold you want?" "It is blood I want. Lord Tywin shall deliver us the Mountain's Head." "And who will deliver us Lord Tywin's head, eh? The Mountain has always been his pet."
The prince gestured toward the pools.
"O'Bara, look at the children, if it please you."
"It does not please me. I'll get more pleasure from driving my spear into Lord Tywin's belly. I'll make him sing the Rains of Castamere as I pull his bowels out and look for gold."
"Look," the prince repeated. "I command you."
A few of the older children lay face down upon the smooth pink marble, browning in the sun. Others paddled in the sea beyond. Three were building a sandcastle with a great spike that resembled the spear tower of the old palace. A score or more had gathered in the big pool to watch the battles as smaller children rowed through the waist-deep shallows on the shoulders of the larger and tried to shove each other into the water. Every time a pair went down, the splash was followed by a roar of laughter. They watched a nut-brown girl yank a tow-headed boy off his brother's shoulders to tumble him head-first into the pool.
"Your father played that same game once, as I did before him," said the prince. "We had 10 years between us, and so I had left the pools by the time he was old enough to play. But I would watch him when I came to visit mother. He was so fierce, even as a boy, quick as a water snake. I often saw him topple boys much bigger than himself. He reminded me of the day he left for King's Landing. He swore that he would do it one more time, else I would never have let him go."
"Let him go?" O'Bara laughed, "as if you could have stopped him. The Red Viper of Dawn went where he would."
"He did. I wish I had some word of comfort."
"I did not come to you for comfort."
Her voice was full of scorn.
"The day my father came to claim me, my mother did not wish me to go. 'She is a girl,' she said, 'and I do not think that she is yours. I had 1,000 other men.' He tossed his spear at my feet and gave my mother the back of his hand across the face. So she began to weep. 'Girl or boy, we fight our battles,' he said. 'But the gods let us choose our weapons.' He pointed to the spear, then to my mother's tears, and I picked up the spear. 'I told you she was mine,' my father said, 'and took me. My mother drank herself to death within the year. They say she was weeping as she died.'" O'Bara edged closer to the prince in his chair.
"Let me use the spear. I ask no more."
"It is a deal to ask, O'Bara. I shall sleep on it."
"You have slept too long already."
"You may be right. I will send word to you at Sunspear."
"So long as the word is war."
O'Bara turned upon her heel and strode off as angrily as she had come, back to the stables for a fresh horse and another headlong gallop down the road. Maester Caliot remained behind.
"My prince," the little round man asked, "do your legs hurt?"
The prince smiled faintly.
Is the sun hot?
Shall I fetch a draught for the pain?
No, I need my wits about me.
The maester hesitated.
My prince, is it prudent to allow Lady Obara to return to Sunspear? She is certain to inflame the common people. They loved your brother well.
So did we all.
He pressed his fingers to his temple.
No, you are right. I must return to Sunspear as well.
The little round man hesitated.
Is that wise?
Not wise, but necessary. Best send a rider to Ricasso and have him open my apartments in the Tower of the Sun. Inform my daughter Ariane that I will be there on the morrow.
My little princess.
The captain had missed her sorely.
You will be seen, the maester warned.
The captain understood. 2 years ago, when they had left Sunspear for the peace and isolation of the water gardens, Prince Dorensgard had not been half so bad. In those days he still walked, albeit slowly, leaning on a stick, and grimacing with every step. The prince did not wish his enemies to know how feeble he had grown, and the old palace and its shadow city were full of eyes.
Eyes, the captain thought, and steps he cannot climb. He would need to fly to sit atop the Tower of the Sun.
I must be seen. Someone must pour oil on the waters. Dawn must be reminded that it still has a prince.
He smiled wanly.
Old and gouty though he is.
If you return to Sunspear, you will need to give audience to Princess Marcella, Caliot said. Her white knight will be with her, and you know he sends letters to his queen.
I suppose he does.
The white knight.
The captain frowned. Sir Ares had come to Dawn to attend his own princess, as Arya Hotar had once come with his. Even their names sounded oddly alike. Arya and Ares. Yet there the likeness ended. The captain had left Norvas and its bearded priests, but Sir Ares Oakheart still served the Iron Throne. Hotar had felt a certain sadness whenever he saw the man in the long snowy cloak, the times the prince had sent him down to Sunspear. One day he sensed the two of them would fight. On that day, Oakheart would die, with the captain's long axe crashing through his skull. He slid his hand along the smooth ashen shaft of his axe, and wondered if that day was drawing nigh.
"The afternoon is almost done," the prince was saying. "We will wait for morn. See that my litter is ready by first light."
"As you command,"
Caliot bobbed a bow. The captain stood aside to let him pass, and listened to his footsteps dwindle.
"Captain?"
The prince's voice was soft. Hotar strode forward, one hand wrapped about his long axe. The ash felt as smooth as a woman's skin against his palm. When he reached the rolling chair, he thumped its butt down hard to announce his presence. But the prince had eyes only for the children.
"Did you have brothers, Captain?" he asked. "Back in Norvas, when you were young, sisters?"
"Both," Hotar said. "Two brothers, three sisters. I was the youngest." "The youngest and unwanted. Another mouth to feed. A big boy who ate too much and soon outgrew his clothes."
Small wonder they had sold him to the bearded priests.
"I was the oldest," the prince said. "And yet I am the last. After Moors and Olivar died in their cradles, I gave up hope of brothers. I was 9 when Elia came, a squire in service at Saltshore. When the raven arrived with word that my mother had been brought to bed a month too soon,
I was old enough to understand that meant the child would not live. Even when Lord Gargallon told me that I had a sister, I assured him that she must shortly die. Yet she lived, by the mother's mercy, and a year later Oberon arrived, squalling and kicking. I was a man grown when they were playing in these pools. Yet here I sit, and they are gone.
Arya Hatar did not know what to say to that. He was only a captain of guards, and still a stranger to this land and its seven-faced god. Even after all these years, serve, obey, protect. He had sworn those vows at 6 and 10, the day he wed his axe. Simple vows for simple men, the bearded priest had said. He had not been trained to counsel grieving princes. He was still groping for some words to say, when another orange fell with a heavy splat, no more than a foot from where the prince was seated. Doran winced at the sound, as if somehow it had hurt him.
"Enough," he sighed. "It is enough. Leave me, Arya. Let me watch the children for a few more hours."
When the sun set, the air grew cool, and the children went inside in search of supper. Still the prince remained beneath the orange trees, looking out over the still pools and the sea beyond. A serving man brought him a bowl of purple olives, with flatbread and cheese and chickpea paste. He ate a bit of it, and drank a cup of the sweet, heavy, strong wine that he loved. When it was empty, he filled it once again. Sometimes, in the deep black hours of the morning, sleep found him in his chair. Only then did the captain roll him down the moonlit gallery, past a row of fluted pillars and through a graceful archway, to a great bed with crisp, cool linen sheets in a chamber by the sea. Doran groaned as the captain moved him, but the guards were good, and he did not wake. The captain's sleeping cell adjoined the prince's. He sat upon the narrow bed and found his whetstone and oilcloth in their niche, and set to work. "Keep your long axe sharp," the bearded priest had told him, the day they branded him. He always did. As he honed the axe, Hotar thought of Norvos, the high city on the hill, and the low beside the river. He could still recall the sounds of the three bells, the way that Noom's deep peals set his very bones to shuddering. The proud, strong voice of Nara, sweet Nile's silvery laughter. The taste of winter cake filled his mouth again, rich with ginger and pine nuts and bits of cherry, with Nasa to wash it down. Fermented goat's milk, served in an iron cup and laced with honey. He saw his mother in her dress with a squirrel collar, the one she wore but once each year, when they went to see the bears dance down the sinner's steps. And he smelled the stench of burning hair as the bearded priest touched the brand to the center of his chest. The pain had been so fierce that he thought his heart might stop. Yet Arya Hotar had not flinched. The hair had never grown back over the axe. Only when both edges were sharp enough to shave with, did the captain lay his ashen-iron wife down on the bed. Yawning, he pulled off his soiled clothes, tossed them on the floor, and stretched out on his straw-stuffed mattress. Thinking of the brand had made it itch, so he had to stretch himself before he closed his eyes.
"I should have gathered up the oranges that fell," he thought, and went to sleep, dreaming of the tart, sweet taste of them, and the sticky feel of the red juice on his fingers. Dawn came too soon. Outside the stables, the smallest of the three horse litters stood ready. The cedarwood litter with the red silk draperies. The captain chose 20 spears to accompany it, out of the 30 who were posted at the winter gardens. The rest would stay to guard the grounds and children, some of whom were the sons and daughters of great lords and wealthy merchants.
Although the prince had spoken of departing at first light, Ariohotar knew that he would dawdle. Whilst the maester helped Doran Martell to bathe and bandaged up his swollen joints in linen wraps soaked with soothing lotions, the captain donned a shirt of copper scales, as befit his rank, and a billowing cloak of dun and yellow sand silk to keep the sun off the copper. The day promised to be hot, and the captain had long ago discarded the heavy horsehair cape and studded leather tunic he had worn in Norvos, which were like to cook a man in dawn. He had kept his iron half-helm, with its crest of sharpened spikes, but now he wore it wrapped in orange silk, weaving the cloth in and around the spikes. Elsewise, the sun beating down on the metal would have his head pounding before they saw the palace. The prince was still not ready to depart. He had decided to break his fast before he went, with a blood orange and a plate of gull's eggs, diced with bits of ham and fiery peppers. Then naught would do but he must say farewell to several of the children who had become especial favourites, the Dort boy and Lady Blackmore's brood, and the round-faced orphan girl whose father had sold cloth and spices up and down the Greenblood. Doran kept a splendid Mearish blanket over his legs as he spoke with them, to spare the young ones the sight of his swollen bandaged joints. It was midday before they got underway, the prince in his litter, Maester Caliot riding on a donkey, the rest afoot. Five spearmen walked ahead and five behind, with five more flanking the litter to either side. Ariohotar himself took his familiar place at the left hand of the prince, resting his long axe on a shoulder as he walked. The road from Sunspear to the water gardens ran beside the sea, so they had a cool, fresh breeze to soothe them as they made their way across a sparse, red-brown land of stone and sand and twisted, stunted trees. Halfway there, the second sand snake caught them. She appeared suddenly upon a dune, mounted on a golden sand steed, with a mane like fine white silk. Even a horse the Lady Nim looked graceful, dressed all in shimmering lilac robes, with a great silk cape of cream and copper that lifted at every gust of wind, and made her look as if she might take flight. Nymeria Sand was 25, and slender as a willow, her straight black hair worn in a long braid, bound up with red gold wire, made a widow's peak above her dark eyes, just as her father's had. With her high cheekbones, full lips, and milk-pale skin, she had all the beauty that her elder sister lacked. But Obara's mother had been an old-town whore, whilst Nim was born from the noblest blood of old Valentis. A dozen mounted spearmen tailed her, their round shields gleaming in the sun. They followed her down the dune. The prince had tied back the curtains on his litter, the better to enjoy the breeze blowing off the sea. Lady Nim fell in beside him, slowing her pretty golden mare to match the litter's pace. "Well met, uncle!" she sang out, as if it had been chance that brought her here. "May I ride with you to Sunspear?" The captain was on the opposite side of the litter from Lady Nim, yet he could hear every word she said. "I would be glad of it," Prince Doran replied, though he did not sound glad to the captain's ears. "Gout and grief make poor companions on the road." By which the captain knew him to mean that every pebble drove a spike through his swollen joints. "The gout I cannot help," she said, "but my father had no use for grief. Vengeance was more to his taste. Is it true that Gregor Clegane admitted slaying Elia and her children?" "He roared out his guilt for all the court to hear," the prince admitted. "Lord Tywin has promised us his head." "And a Lannister always pays his debts," said Lady Nim. "Yet it seems to me that Lord Tywin means to pay us with our own coin.
I had a bird from our sweet Sir Damon, who swears my father tickled that monster more than once as they fought. If so, Sir Gregor is as good as dead. And no thanks to Tywin Lannister.
The prince grimaced. Whether it was from the pain of gout or his niece's words, the captain could not say.
It may be so. Maybe. I say tis. Obara would have me go to war.
Nim laughed.
Yes, she wants to set the torch to Old Town. She hates that city as much as our little sister loves it. And you?
Nim glanced over her shoulder to where her companions rode a dozen lengths behind.
I was abed with the Fowler twins when the word reached me,
the captain heard her say.
You know the Fowler words? Let me soar. That is all I ask of you. Let me soar, uncle. I need no mighty host, only one sweet sister.
Obara?
Tyeen. Obara is too loud. Tyeen is so sweet and gentle that no man will suspect her. Obara would make Old Town our father's funeral pyre. But I am not so greedy. Four lives will suffice for me. Lord Tywin's golden twins, as payment for Elia's children, the old lion for Elia herself, and last of all, the little king for my father. The boy has never wronged us. The boy is a bastard born of treason, incest, and adultery, if Lord Stannis can be believed.
The playful tone had vanished from her voice, and the captain found himself watching her through narrowed eyes. Her sister Obara wore her whip upon her hip, and carried a spear where any man could see it. Lady Nim was no less deadly, though she kept her knives well hidden.
Only royal blood can wash out my father's murder. Oberon died during single combat fighting in a matter that was none of his concern. I do not call that murder. Call it what you will. We sent them the finest man in Dorne, and they are sending back a bag of bones. He went beyond anything I asked of him. Take the measure of this boy king and his council, and make note of their strengths and weaknesses, I told him, on the terrace. We were eating oranges. Find us friends, if there are any to be found. Learn what you can of Elia's end, but see that you do not provoke Lord Tywin unduly. Those are my words to him. Oberon laughed and said, "When have I provoked any man? Unduly. You would do better to warn the Lannisters against provoking me. He wanted justice for Elia, but he would not wait. He waited 10 and 7 years, the Lady Nim broke in. Were it you they killed, my father would have led his banners north before your corpse was cold. Were it you, the spears would be falling thick as rain upon the marshes now. I do not doubt it. No more should you doubt this, my prince. My sisters and I shall not wait 10 and 7 years for our vengeance."
She put her spurs into the mare, and she was off, galloping toward Sunspear with her tail in hot pursuit. The prince leaned back against his pillow and closed his eyes. But Huttar knew he did not sleep. He is in pain. For a moment he considered calling Maester Caliot up to the litter, but if Prince Doran had wanted him, he would have called himself. The shadows of the afternoon were long and dark, and the sun was as red and swollen as the prince's joints, before they glimpsed the towers of Sunspear to the east. First the slender spear tower, 100.5 feet tall, crowned with a spear of gilded steel that added another 30 feet to its height. Then the mighty Tower of the Sun, with its dome of gold and leaded glass. Last, the dun-coloured sand ship, looking like some monstrous Drummond that had washed ashore and turned to stone.
Only 3 leagues of coast road divided Sunspear from the water gardens, yet they were 2 different worlds. There children frolicked naked in the sun, music played in tiled courtyards, and the air was sharp with the smell of lemons and